In the next 30 minutes, God will speak to some of you here today and change the direction of your life. Listen carefully for what he might have to say to you. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, there's the story there of Israel in conflict again with the Palestinian or the Palestine or the Philistine people. The Philistines had assembled on a hill of Succoth in Judah. And on a neighboring place, King Saul had assembled his army. For 40 days there had been a standoff because the Philistines appeared to have a weapon of mass destruction by which the Israelites had been totally intimidated, too frightened to join in the inevitable battle. The weapon stood 3 meters tall, and on the right side there was a spear, the iron tip of which alone weighed 7 kilograms. On his back there hung a huge sword. His body was covered by 57 kilograms of bronze armor, and for additional protection, a bearer accompanied him with carrying a great shield. This was the giant Goliath. Day after day, for 40 days, he came out to do battle with anyone who was courageous or silly enough to take on his challenge. And every day he cursed by his gods, and he dared the thoroughly intimidated, terrorized Israelites to send anyone to fight him, winner take all. Every day, as the Israelites listened to that bellowing, threatening roar, they quaked with fear. And then came day 41. On that day, there arrived in the camp of King Saul a youth who'd been sent by his father, Jesse, to bring supplies to this boy's older brothers in the camp. The only thing to commend his presence to the soldiers was that he was able to play good tunes on a stringed instrument, but there was little thought of music and celebration in this camp. When David heard the daunting daily dare of the roaring Goliath, he immediately offered to deal with the fellow permanently. He had only one precondition, that he not be obliged to wear King Saul's armor, because that was too cumbersome. He'd do better without it. Armed only with a sling and 5 small stones, which he had selected from a nearby stream, he walked on alone to face the giant. Goliath naturally felt insulted to be confronted with a mere unarmed boy. And so by his gods, he cursed David, to which David replied, "I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, whom you have defied. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's." David was aware of this because the day on which Samuel had anointed him to be the future king of Israel, the Bible says the Spirit of the Lord had come upon him in power. On day 41, a youth refused to be intimidated by the terrorizing taunts of the enemy. And he looked not at the size of the giant, but at the greatness of his God. The giant was slain. The enemy was routed. For almost 1,400 years, since Arab Muslim armies first stormed out of what is today known as the Arabian Peninsula, in the first 100 years of their aggression, they overran governments and church right across northern Africa, sweeping up through Spain and into southern France in the west. To the east, they went to the north, to the edges of China, the south cutting through to what is today called Afghanistan. And God's people on earth, the church, has been mostly immobilized by fear, crippled by terror, weakened and intimidated through its own unbelief. And it shows in how few workers we have ever sent out to be amongst those people. Of the approximate 1,700 totally unreached people groups in the world today, most of those are of Muslim peoples. For 1,400 years, in typical Goliath fashion, in accordance precisely with what is written in their sacred texts, they have cursed us. They have said that they are the best and all others are the worst of all creatures, and as such we are doomed to burn in hell forever. It is shouted that they are the winners and all others are the losers. It is declared that they will rule the world. And it says that when the Islamic Jesus returns, he will smash all crosses, he will kill all pigs, and then call upon non-Muslims to bow down to Allah, and for any who refuse that request, they are to be killed. It says that the Holy Bible and the God of the Bible are gross corruptions, and only the Quran and Allah's messenger, their prophet Muhammad, represent truth. For 1,400 years, with comparatively few exceptions, we have listened to the roar of that giant, and we have mostly abandoned the field of contest and crouched down behind the flimsy, temporary security shields of geographical distance and occasional military and economic superiority. We had hoped that somehow the inevitable conflict might be avoided. And so in our times, we have busied ourselves by building ever bigger barns, pursuing environmental agendas, debating the ordination to ministry of practicing same-sex couples, and many other seemingly important social issues. Many modern King Sauls have arisen to speak on our behalf, and our political leaders tell us, with what is happening around the world, that is not the real Islam, which is a religion of peace. Many of our religious leaders have said we should not disturb Muslims with our Christian message. We just need dialogue. After all, we do worship the same God, don't we? And all we need is to be friends and all will be well. In this, our political and religious elite reveal their willful ignorance of Islam's sacred texts and its well-documented 1,400 years of religious and military conquest. Jesus of the Bible said that he was the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except by him. And what he has accomplished on the cross, through his life, his teaching, his death, and his resurrection, and only then, as that is received and obeyed, is it possible to restore a relationship with the living God. However, all of this is emphatically denied and rejected by Islam. Jesus also said, "If we, the church, remain silent, then even the stones will cry out." And so in view of the church's indecision and unresponsiveness, the Lord of the church, Jesus, in our time, is stepping out and taking an initiative to achieve that which he has always desired, that people from every tribe, every nation, every language should come and bow before Jesus and confess that he alone is Lord. He does not intend that 1.8 billion people should miss out on his invitation to worship before the throne of God because they are Muslims. He doesn't want them to miss that. Michael Stolik is a senior preacher in the Wetzlar Cathedral north of Frankfurt in Germany. As he stood one Sunday morning not so long ago, farewelling the worshippers who'd been there in that service, there approached him a fully veiled Muslim woman. Thinking that she was a beggar looking for money, he started to reach in his pocket for some, and she replied, No, I am not here for money. I have a question. Are you the imam of this place? Well, actually, I'm not the imam. I am called the pastor, and I lead this place. Well, you will do. You're the person I need to speak with. You're the right man. Because last night, God commanded me in a dream that I should go to the imam of the big church there in the city square and ask him for truth, and that you would tell me what the truth is. And so Michael, over ensuing weeks and months, met repeatedly with her, teaching her about Jesus, the Bible, and so forth. And then, after some months, she, along with numbers of others in her network, were baptized into the faith. Today, across the cities of Europe and in Middle Eastern refugee camps, many other Muslims are finding Jesus. What is happening in Iran is a good example. In 1979, Ayatollah Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini re-entered the land. He declared the birth of the Islamic Republic, and in a famous speech, he promised the people that not only would there be paradise in heaven, but now there would be paradise on earth with the coming of the Islamic Revolution. Today, the country is in a state of unprecedented, chaotic decline. Some paradise. What happened in the church, of course, is what happened wherever Islam takes over in any country. The churches were closed. Any bells were silenced according to Islam's ancient edicts. Other churches were prohibited from using even the national language in their services, lest someone understand what they're trying to say. The Bible was restricted. Christian broadcasting blocked. Christians were imprisoned. Key leaders have been executed. And so what has been the result of all of that? In 1979, it was estimated there are approximately 500 believers from Muslim background who'd accepted Jesus. By 2008, that number had increased to 220,000. By 2016, an estimate placed the number of evangelical believers in Iran was 1 million people, the majority of whom were Muslims who had come to faith in that time. In 2013, the largest church in the nation, in Tehran, was closed down by the government. There were 1,000 people who had been worshipping in that church. The government closed it. The people scattered. They formed little cell groups all over the place. 3 years later, in 2016, the leaders of that church, they say, it was the best thing ever that the government should close us down. Previously, we had 1,000. Now we have 50,000 people in our church. It's Acts chapter 2 all over again. When the Bible was restricted, curiosity was increased. A government official appeared on television waving the recently new translation of the New Testament, warning people not to read this dangerous book. And guess what that did? Curiosity was aroused. Demand soared. In 1990, the government therefore closed the Bible Society. But in 2015, the banned Bible Society still managed to distribute 150,000 printed copies of the Bible within Iran. When a Bible app was opened in this country, that was the one where 50,000 downloads occurred in a couple of hours. In 2016, 1 million digital Bibles, 500,000 digital New Testaments were downloaded. One leader with whom I relate on that scene, he said in his own particular work, they've seen 500 new fellowships established in over 90 cities across Iran. When Christians were jailed, people asked, who is this Jesus that people are prepared to stand up for and go to jail? When leaders were executed, their willingness to die united the church. Associate pastors were then appointed with the provision that when the senior pastor was jailed or was killed, they would step up to become the senior pastors. In one church, they said, "What a privilege it has been for us to offer three of our pastors as martyrs for Jesus. But what a waste of a good life it would be not to die as a martyr for Jesus." Next door in Iraq, in the midst of all the bombing and killing, in a 19-year period, one church there went from 6 people to 15,000 people. 2,000 of those had been previously Muslims. 7,000 were able to flee to neighboring countries as refugees, but 1,276 members of the congregation were killed. In 1 week, 13 Muslims came inquiring of the pastor there about Jesus. They said, "We're sick of all of the killing. There must be a better way. Tell us about your Jesus." And so he taught them. They said, "Well, we want to be baptized." He said, "You understand if you're baptized, Muslims understand baptism a lot better than Christians do, because baptism cuts off everything in the past and you open your life to a new future, and you'll be considered as apostate. And the penalty for apostasy in Islam for men is death. For women, it's imprisonment. We don't care." They're all baptized. Of that 13, within 1 week, 11 of them had been murdered. Heaven rejoices about the 220,000 Muslims across 18 sub-Saharan African countries who, in a period of just 7 years, became followers of Jesus. Or last year up in Aceh, the toughest province in Indonesia, governed by Sharia law, 700 people were baptized up there. You see, Muslims across the world are tired of all of the fighting and the killing, and they say in the last 3 decades, more Muslims have been killed by other Muslims than all of the fighting which has gone on and the killing with non-Muslims. They're tired of that. And so they come and they say, there has to be a better way. They're looking for hope. They're looking for assurance. They're looking for freedom. They're yearning for a relationship with God, which is totally denied them within Islam. In the city of Tirana in Albania, where I was a couple of weeks ago, 2 young men were unemployed. Unemployment is very high in Albania. They got caught up in drugs, gangs, alcohol. And the worse things got, the more disturbed their parents became. And so repeatedly they'd go to the mosque to read the Quran and to pray and to Allah, asking for his help. But as usual, nothing happened. One day, some young adults from a local church invited the boys to go camping with them up in the mountains. And they came back from that experience totally changed. And the parents noticed the change. They said, what's caused this? They said, "Oh, it's simple. We met someone called Jesus. We're now a follower of Jesus." "Oh, no. Now there is more shame poured upon us in our community. You have become apostate. You have joined the infidels. How could you do this to us?" So again, they kept going back to the mosque repeatedly to pray and to beg Allah to change things. But the boys never changed. They just became more and more joyful. And after some months, against the wishes of the parents, the mother herself tippy-toed and secretly crept into this church where these boys were now going. Guess what? She discovered Jesus. The father was very upset. But some months later, he also came into the church tippy-toeing. And guess what? He found Jesus. But that left Grandma. And Grandma cursed them. She hated them. How could they do this and risk their whole eternal future, this wretched lot of apostate infidels? The family gathered and agreed not to answer Grandma in a hostile way, but to pray for Grandma. Eventually, Grandma tippy-toed into church. Guess what? She found Jesus. In talking with those people, the mother said to me, "Pastor Stewart, you have got no idea what our lives were like. The more trouble our boys were in, the more we went to the mosque to pray, to read the Quran, to beg Allah to help us. And the more we did this, the more we seemed to be ever tightly more bound and descending deeper and deeper into a black, fathomless hole. And it was terrible. And then suddenly we discovered Jesus and we had freedom and we came out into the light. Pastor Stu, you've got no idea what that is like. And indeed you don't. And when I hear those sorts of testimonies, I do in the places in which I inhabit, my heart sings. But then when I'm alone, my heart weeps as I think of the hundreds of millions of Muslims who will never, ever, ever hear of anything of Jesus. The giant of Islam shouts, "You can't have a relationship with God. He is too distant and too unknowable." The spirit of Islam roars that the Bible is corrupt, that Jesus never died on the cross. But in spite of all of the scorn and the derision and the death which has been inflicted upon the church for 1400 years, the God of our world is turning all of these things to good. This is not a time for doom and gloom. It is not a time to cower down with fear or uncertainty. Perfect love casts out fear, and we need to love these Muslim people. We need to shrug off our prejudices, to reorient our priorities, and to reach out to Muslims who are precious treasures in God's sight, whom He longs to call back to Himself from being locked up in darkness and deceit for all of this time. For generations, a small number of missionaries have gone out into the Muslim countries, and they have prayed, they have toiled, they have died, often without seeing any fruit for their labors. As one of them said, "For 30 years we have worked and saw no fruit, but at least we have been used to remove the stones from the field and to plant some seed. And indeed the seed is good and has been planted, but now it is harvest time." More Muslims have accepted Jesus Christ in the last 40 years than has happened in the last 1400 years. And Jesus is running loose out there in the Muslim world, and He's inviting us to come join Him in the harvest to help to bring it in. But unless we do, that harvest may be lost. To the church in Philadelphia, Jesus would say, "See, I have placed before you an open door which no one can shut." And to us He says, "Come, come, follow Me." And He never said anything about coming back. The Jesus who died on the cross for us all still brings the dead to life, and He wants to bring 1.8 billion Muslims. He wants to free them from being deceived, to bring them into the truth, to come from darkness to light, from death to life. And He wants to do it through you. It's time to shrug off our small ambitions. It's time to make Jesus' last command our first priority. It is day 41. It's our time to stand up, to seize the initiative, to go forth with no thought of ever coming back.